Okay, I'm going to get started here. So last class I started talking about disk head scheduling, and here's a picture of a disk. Well, maybe it's not that easy to see, but this is the head here, and it moves kind of like this. And these are platters. I don't know whether it rotates counterclockwise or clockwise, but they move like this, sort of. And that's pretty much what I was trying to draw, but my drawings weren't great. But it's like the old-fashioned record players. Okay, so it traces a track on the disk, and these tracks are broken up into sectors, and they're renumbered into block numbers, and all that is taken care of by the hardware. So to us, a disk is a sequence of blocks. So there will be constant debate about hard drive versus SSD. Are we going to stick to old-fashioned hard drives, or are we going to move to SSDs? And for the foreseeable future, they are two different things in terms of applications. Things may change. For now, these things are still expensive and better for read traffic. Now, if we look at do we use storage devices like SSDs or hard drives for reading or for writing, or both? Simply put, oversimplifying, when we are using our personal computers, laptops or desktops, majority of the disk traffic is read. It is opening programs, doing things, loading stuff, we really do not produce a lot of output that needs to be written. We might save some files from somewhere, but the write traffic is a lot lower. But when you're talking about cloud computing or those people who run data centers, majority traffic is write. They are constantly updating information, data, newly created data. You're adding user-generated content out there. It's becoming centralized and goes in there. On top of that, they have to, for reliability reasons, often maintain multiple copies or backup copies. Backup is 100% write. It rarely gets written, but you need it to be there so that if you need to read the data back up, you can do that. So there's a lot of write traffic in data centers, so which is another reason why hard drives are preferred there, not SSDs. Now, when will technology move on to better SSDs and maybe something else? We don't know. But currently, hard drives are here to stay. Second thing is that the hard drive model, this thing has led to the design of interfaces, that is I/O and device drivers, is pretty much, be it for network, SSD, printers, etc. So there's a whole bunch of devices that are not hard drives. But their interfaces, the I/O interface, the device drivers, etc., they purposely designed that to make these things look like hard drives, which is why the hard drive interface is still so important. SSDs can be done by using a RAM-like interface. It's not done that way. The hardware interface that plugs into the computer tells the computer this is a hard drive for compatibility reasons, etc. So the concept of hard drive is going to stay for a long, long time, even if the technology under it changes. So that's why we were talking about hard drives. Of course, scheduling algorithms The scheduling algorithms, however, I have to say, are unique to hard drives. Head movement doesn't occur in SSDs or networks or printers or things like that. It's just an artifact of the platter and the read-write head flying on top of the platter. So FCFS, I think we discussed. Much head movement. However, think of it the following way. There's a low traffic and a high traffic situation. So you've got a head and you need to pick up data here, and so you move your head here. Let's say we have a very low traffic situation. Currently, I want to pick up data from here. And future ones which are waiting, there's nothing. So you have to pick up this. When you're done, the next one is here. How can you schedule? You cannot. You have a choice of one. If you have a choice of five, you can schedule. Okay, out of this five, I'm going to pick one. So if the rate of arrival of requests are lower than the speed at which you can service them, then all scheduling protocols will be first come, first serve. Moment the request arrives, you do it. It will, yes, your disk head will move, but there's no choice. If there's a backlog, there's a bunch of waiting things, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 2 is over here, 3 is over here, 4 is over here, etc., then you can say that instead of going to 2, I might as well go to 3 first. So scheduling happens only if there's a backlog. Otherwise, it degenerates to first come, first serve anyway. Now, the rest of the algorithms are pretty straightforward. Now this is too dynamic for me to draw it, but if I look at the thing like they came in this order, the request came in this order, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm servicing 1, I will do 4 next. Now I will do 4 next, and if nothing changes, I will do 2 next, then I'll do 3 next. However, when I'm doing four, if the fifth request comes here, I'll go there. When I'm doing the fifth request, if the sixth request comes over here, I'm going to go there. So it depends upon at every point when I'm doing one, just about when I finish one, what is the closest? And this will minimize my head movement. But there's an obvious flaw with this, which is starvation. Some requests may never get done. They will if the traffic decreases, everything becomes first come, first serve, it's the fairest, and things will get done. But under high traffic loads, your head will tend to stay at some area, be it that side or this side or middle, and not venture out to the other extremities. And so this is not considered not a good idea. So first come, first serve is not good. SSTF is great, but not good. Scan is the elevator algorithm. You're at some location, you will go to the shortest one. You will seek the shortest seek time first. In the direction of travel. What's your direction of travel? I've drawn direction of travel is this way. So it'll pick up 1, 3, 4, 2. By that time, when it's doing 4, maybe something will appear here, but that's not in the direction of travel. So it will not go there, it'll keep going. So you will not have starvation, you will scan the whole thing first, you will end up at the end, and then you will reverse your direction of travel. And whatever is accumulated by then, you're going to sweep that off. And while you're doing that, newer things may appear in your direction of travel or behind you. And they will be picked up only if they're in the direction of travel. And for obvious reasons, this is called the elevator algorithm. And I believe that's it. There are some variations. C-scan has only one direction of travel, which means it goes up only and retracts all the way down without picking up anybody. And it's not really an elevator algorithm, but it goes from one endpoint, kind of like a modulo operation, circulates back, retraction's pretty fast, and then you go again. Just a variation, doesn't make much of a... And then finally, there is look... Now, I purposely didn't say some strange thing about scan. Pure scan would go one direction and go all the way, even if you don't have any requests over there. Waste of time. Why would you do that? Of course you wouldn't do that. It's just defined that way. So look is better. You travel in one direction. This is the last one. Everything's on this side. Don't go to the end. Just go the other way. Obvious. Obvious optimization is look. And you can do look and see look, but you retract all the way and then come. So those are the disk head scheduling operations. I think I covered this last time. So I'm not going to write the code for this, but in our simple device driver, we put a P mutex here to keep the requests waiting in our device driver so that the one that is being serviced is in here, it wakes up and signals the next one. And that'll be FIFO. Semaphores are FIFO. So you don't use semaphores. You use some sort of a key queue that gets rearranged every time you want to do a wake up from a P operation, and those will be tagged with the location of the previous one, location of now, and some algorithm which will figure out what. FIFO, the V operation is waking up the oldest process or thread. Here you'll wake up the thread that is best in terms of SSTF or scan or whatever it is that you're trying to do. Okay? Okay, this is stuff that I will not pretend that I know about. But in concept, what's going on is that disks have partitions, and one of the partition is called the boot partition, and there's something called the master boot record. At the beginning of, going back, a disk is a sequence of blocks all numbered. Fine. At the beginning of the disk, in block number 0 or 1 or somewhere in there, probably block number 0, there are two things. One is the partition table and the other is the master boot record. And it's a very fixed format that is interpreted by the bootloader, which is part of the BIOS of the machine. And over years, now it has become standardized so that all everything's a PC Intel based, and they all assume that the boot record is structured in this particular way, etc. And I'm not sure what they are structured like. But the partition table So at the beginning there's the partition table. The partition table is a table, pretty small, arranged as 0, 1, 2, which has the start and end of each of the partitions. What is a partition? Logical
division
of the disk. Logical division of the disk. Yeah. So, a disk is a contiguous sequence of blocks. You can have it just like this, it will be called a single partition. You can pretend that this one disk is really multiple disks. And then you say that it has multiple partitions. So, a partition disk was done due to historic reasons. It's still used, but nothing very important. That is, you say that I don't have one disk. I have three separate hard drives. And from the zeroth block to a certain number of block is my first hard drive, partition zero. Then it's my second hard drive. Then it's my third hard drive. It's all pretense. And so the blocks get renumbered. And where exactly are the starts and ends are in the partition table, and the device drivers are actually the hardware can figure all this little jugglery around. And one of them is marked as the boot. And that contains the master boot record. And the master boot record is a set of pointers to files bootloaders or operating systems. That's kind of a little fuzzy in my mind. So the master boot record is a record which says I have a few operating systems here, and you can jump to this one or that one. No, there is only one master boot record, I think. I don't know enough about this topic. Okay, I may be making some mistakes here. You might want to check. It's not very important from the operating system point of view because the operating system starts after all this is done. This is the even lower BIOS thing where in the disk there's enough information, very rudimentary information of how to do booting. Where is the software that does the booting? It's part of the master boot record of that operating system, the master boot record which is pointing to the bootloader of that operating system. And if you are using a multiple booted machine, there's some kind of grub or whatever that will let you choose which one you want to use. And otherwise it just goes to the default active boot partition. Okay? So again, at the beginning of the partition is a bit vector containing all the containing the free list. The free list on disk is not a list; it's a bit vector. What that means is that, let's say you've got n blocks of the disk. You can calculate how many blocks in a terabyte disk, how many bytes per block. I don't know, and you can calculate that. And so you'll get some millions of blocks on the disk, maybe more. That many bits will be statically allocated first. So let's say you've got a million blocks on your disk. There'll be a million bits here. Million divided by 8 will be the number of bytes here. And each of these bits correspond to a block, and those bits which are set to 1 says that this block is not in use. This is the free bit vector. And that's how the operating system using this, the operating system maintains the free list. The free list is a bunch of bits saying at this position there are free blocks. And when you go and allocate the block, you just set the bit to 0, and this is stored on the disk so that even if you power down, you power up, you don't lose the information as to which block is free and which block is used. So this is part of what's called metadata. It talks about how the storage space on that partition, disk and a partition is about the same thing, is organized in terms of free and used blocks. Okay? Talking about disks, since we're at the lower level of things, there is a bunch of stuff that are commonly in use today. At reliable data storage locations, which is called RAID. What is it? Redundant. It is redundant arrays of inexpensive disks. However, the politically correct term these days is independent disks. It started up as inexpensive disks. You want to build a disk farm, you buy lots and lots of inexpensive disks, and you build something reliable and high performance out of it. That's the idea behind RAID. And RAID has evolved into so many different techniques. We could do maybe 10 classes on RAID. I'm just going to give you a quick overview, 5 minutes, on what is the various types of RAID. So just two kinds, or maybe three I'll talk about. RAID level 0. So there's about 10 levels of RAID. There are hybrids which mix and match RAIDs. Then there are hybrids that mix and match hard drives and SSDs, such that the SSDs are caches to the hard drive only when there's read-only memory. There's just a massive array of how can we optimize these disk farms. So a quick glimpse into it. And also, this is all packaged inside the hardware. So when you have a RAID, or you have a hybrid, or you have a SSD hard drive hybrid, the operating system doesn't have a clue. That's all hidden at a lower level. The operating system believes you have a disk, you read and write to it. So just like things like pipelining is completely hidden from software, this stuff is hidden from software. Now, RAID 0 is not RAID, because there's no redundancy here. Everything is important. It is a way of gaining performance. That is, the first block of the first virtual block of the device is broken into four pieces and put on four physically different disk drives, not four partitions. So that you have four disk heads trying to find that. And when the four disk heads line up, you will get a transfer rate four times as fast, provided you have four disk interfaces into the operating system. So you put 1/4 of the block here, over here, and you can parallelly read them all if you want this big block to be read from disk or written from disk. So you have four times the capacity on this disk because you have four disks, and you'll get four times the speed also. If everything lines up properly, if your heads are all in different places, you won't get it. But hopefully things will work synchronously for all the disks, and the movement will be the same. It'll be lockstep, and you get a much better performance increase. And that's RAID 0. You see the point? See, your blocks, either your blocks are bigger, four times as big, or your blocks are the same size as the disk and you only put 1/4 the material in there. There are zillions of ways of doing this and the other ones. You could even stripe bits. Bit 1 is here, bit 2 is here, bit 3 is here, bit 4 is here, bit 5 is there. So you can stripe blocks, you can stripe bits, you can stripe bytes. You have lots of options here. Okay, mirroring red 1 doesn't give you the speed increase of red 0. It only gives you reliability increase a lot. That is, two disks are completely mirrored. Every time you write to both places in parallel. So you're not spending any more time to write than one disk. When you read from just one of them. And everything's great. It looks like there's only one disk. All the read traffic goes here. The write traffic goes to both places. So this one only does write traffic.
When you say that you don't spend any more time writing, is that because of the driver sending the write?
Yeah, the driver simultaneously sends it to two different disks.
So from an operating system perspective, you're only writing?
You're only writing once, but the driver is writing twice, not sequentially, in parallel. So the time taken is the same. And all the writes come here. So why are we doing this? One of these disks, doesn't matter which, someday is going to crash. Both won't. Moment you see a disk crash, you just throw it away, put in a new one, run regenerate, it'll make a fresh copy. But you're spending twice the amount of storage. So you're... To store 1 gigabyte, you need 2 gigabytes of disk. But you're pretty much guaranteed nothing is guaranteed, but you're very highly guaranteed you'll never have a disk crash. Logically, you will have disk crashes. The idea was you buy a bunch of inexpensive, not very good disks, and you build your disk farm, and as things crash, you just replace them, and you don't lose any data. Okay. Okay, I'm going to draw the easy to understand version of RAID 2, but there are lots of different ways of doing this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Doesn't have to be same spindle, but sometimes they do it. Now, it's completely separate disk drives, but see, the platters are spinning. You put them on the same spindle so that they're exactly spinning the same way. And you put the read-write head on the same thing, so it moves full thing. So when the read-write head is somewhere on this huge disk, they're all at the same track. And when you want to write data or whatever, every byte... So you get bit number 0 over here, bit number 1, bit number 2, and up to 8th bit. And this is a parity bit. Okay? So you are adding one extra disk for every 8 disks that you are using. This can be modified to be only one extra for 2. There's a many ways. This is not the cheapest or the best way, but this is the easiest to understand. Every byte is striped bit by bit. And one of the bits is a parity. And if you get a disk crash on any one of them, you just pull it out and put in another one, hot swap it. Now all your data is gone. But because you have the parity, you can regenerate all the data. Also, if your parity drive fails, it doesn't matter, you regenerate it. How do you regenerate it? Let's do a 2-bit parity. 00 is 0, 0, 1 is 1, 1, 0 is 1, 1, 1 is 0. Now, I tell you that this guy is dead. Can you figure out what the bits on that would be? You see, 0, 0, this has to be 0. You see, 0, 1, this has to be 1. So you can regenerate this whole thing. So you have a little added extra disk, and now any one disk failing, you can just throw it away and redo it. You don't care. And this can be done with lesser weight and error-correcting codes, and there's a lot of various methods and protocols to do this. And we'll stop here. There is RAID 3, RAID 4, RAID 5, which mixes and matches all kinds of techniques that people have thought about to either enhance performance or to enhance reliability, and it goes from there. This is for reliability. You'll get a speed increase also. You'll get a speed increase because of striping, reliability because of redundancy, one extra per so many disks. So you'll have an error-correcting disk and a data disk. And doesn't matter which one fails, it can be regenerated. But this is below the file system. There is no concept of... The disks are just... bytes, and you look at, and you keep everything synchronous, and you look at just data coming in, coming out, but you're not worried about the semantics of the data, or what is it? Is it software? Is it data? Is it being, what's the name of the file? When was it created? None of this stuff is in here. This is at the raw data storage level. So, when I look at a raw disk, there is a piece of that disk which is not accessible because it has master boot records and free lists and some other stuff, and the rest of the disk is numbered blocks. This is for useful data. However, data storage, long-term data storage using numbered blocks is completely useless. Why? Oh, you've stored a document in there. And if you're told your document really is in block number 100 and 135 and 173, please write it down. You'll need these numbers whenever you want this document. That's not how things work. Okay? So we need a human-friendlier way of organizing a disk so that we don't deal with numbers. We deal with names and structure that humans can relate to. And converting this huge disk, which is just blocks and data storage in there, into something that is more tangible, because we want to be able to remember document names, and if we forget, we want a list of the document names, and we want them in various different locations so that we can organize our files, and that's called a file system. Now, we don't do that for memory. Memory doesn't have a naming system because memory is transient. Memory is used for running programs, and your program, high-level programming language, has names of variables which are thrown away at compile time, and some mishmash of that code in machine language runs. and we do not, as humans, we don't care. Program runs, application runs. But we do care about stuff on disk because this is where we store things. And we want to be able to retrieve things. I want to open this file. I want to run this app. They're all stored in there, and there has to be some kind of naming scheme. And if everything on a computer disk is named, that's a million names. That's not going to work very well. So we need even further refinement of this naming scheme. And that is what a file system does. And the file system is a major repository of data that points to where things are and what are they called. And this entire file system, which is this index or something like that, also is stored on the disk. It's not separate. So the disk contains actual data or programs and a bunch of data about where things are and what is the organization of that disk. So data and metadata. So this is a crude diagram which says in your data part of the disk, there will be all kinds of files, different things, thrown into blocks of the disk in completely random, haphazard manner. So it could be that these three blocks comprise your Word document. These things are comprised some app that's stored on your thing or your operating system or whatever. They're all mixed up. So the metadata is where the names of these things are stored and a bunch of pointers saying where this is. And these two things are not necessarily completely separate. They are also mixed up. And the design of a file system is to figure out how to arrange metadata and data and what structures are supported by this naming scheme. Okay? So let's look at this thing a little theoretically at first, and then we will talk about an actual implementation of how it looks like internally. So the concept of a file, this is each unit of storage as visible to a human, is a file. A file internally contains a sequence of bytes in a particular order. Okay? Just now, what do these bytes contain? Are they ASCII text? Are they programs? Are they machine code? None of that is really relevant to an operating system. That's whatever you put in it. Everything that is in files are really binary. They're all numbers. Each byte is a number. Now, whether you put a picture in it, a video in it, a PDF file in it, a Word file in it, or a program in it, they're not different. They're all just numbers. So at the bottom end, we just store a container which contains numbers. Each number is a byte, and we store it in this sequential order. So all files are sequential. There is something called random access and all that comes later. At the base level, all files are sequential. They contain a sequence of bytes, and it's uninterpreted. That is, the OS doesn't care what these bytes mean. They mean something to a human, a program, or whatever. To the OS, it means nothing. Fine? But in addition to the data stored in the file, we have a bunch of attributes of the file. This is data about the file, which also has to be stored, but is not stored in the file. It's stored somehow associated with the file. So the name of the file is whatever you choose. So that's the name. You can give it a name, and the operating system has some rules about who's the owner, when was it created, what permissions does the owner, even the owner can have no right permissions. You can set your permissions in various ways. So that is, there is the size. There is about a whole lot more. The more things are evolving, the more set of attributes are being added to the file system. So this is just an example of a few attributes of a file system, of a particular file. So now, each file has a set of attributes and a set of contents. Then there's the concept of file types. Now, I did say, is it a Word file? Is it a PDF? Is it an executable? Is it this? File types doesn't exist. Nobody believes me on that. Doesn't matter. But you'll say file types are determined by extension. A PDF file is a .pdf. That is only a certain convention in the Windows operating system. That's not true for Linux. Okay, but we follow that convention in general because we humans like rules. You don't have to name your PDF files .pdf. You may run into a little problem, but it'll work kind of fine. Okay, except that we'd rather name our files .pdf. That way we know it's a PDF file and life is better. There is something called a magic number also, which I don't want to get into, that the Linux system uses. It's the first 2 bytes of a file determine its contents. There are some signatures in the first 2 bytes that tells applications what is probably the contents of the file. And so these two are just kind of conventions that various operating systems use to handle files, but they're not mandatory. But it works better if we do this. But in a puristic point of view, files don't have types. Files are just a bunch of binary in there. Now, actually create, read, write, delete, set permissions. The whole discussion of this can get quite complicated, but that's not for this class. This is like how to use a computer. So we're not going there. But no, at the system call level, that's programming. How do you read and write files? In which order do you read? What is the file handle? What is the this? That's basic programming, or kind of like how to use. But there's create commands and delete commands and all that stuff. But from what we are interested, these are things that are supported by the file system and has effect on bits and bytes on the disk to make it possible. And files also have semantics of the sort, is like, how do you read, let's talk about reading, how do you read a file? There's a pointer that points to a file, and the read is almost always sequential. So you read from there and you read like this. Every time you do a read operation on the file, you get the next bit of the file. But what if you wanted to do random reads or random writes into the file? Is that possible? Yes, it's possible. 99% or huge percent of the time, files are just used as sequential. Random access, ISAM access, there's something called direct access, is also allowed. That is, you can take this pointer and reposition it anywhere in the file, and then you can do sequential reads or sequential writes from that position. Or you can also, in certain systems, will allow direct. That means you say, I want the 29th byte of the file. I'm not interested in the sequential access. Or there is something that I think is out of fashion these days. ISAM is index sequential access method, where you have a tree built into the file and you can jump pointers and go, and then there is another sequence in there. So it gets complex structures that are stored in the file, managed by some user-level libraries which implements pointers in a file. Generally, you don't put pointers in a file, but you can. And the pointers will not be pointers to memory locations, but pointers to file locations. So that can also be done, addressing within the file. So all this is supported by the file system. And then, I guess some people have started calling these folders. They've always been called directories, but directories is too complicated a word. We call them directories. Directories are containers for files. According to humans, they really do not contain files. But we think of directories or folders as a thing that contains files. That's how it shows up graphically on our screen. You open a directory or folder, there's a bunch of files in there. Actually, it's different. We will get to how these things are implemented. Now, there's something called a flat file system, which we don't use. It's like the flat earth thing. Flat file system is where there is one directory, but you don't need a name for that directory because it's the only one you have. And all the files are in there. Directories do not contain directories. Directories contain files. And if you follow that rule, you'll get a flat file system. So all your files are in one location. So that will be useless because there will be too many files all mixed up and we'll never find anything. Okay? So the concept has moved on to from flat file systems, which is ages ago, to two-level directories to multi-level directories. Two-level directories, never mind. This is the most common thing. A directory contains files and directories. And there is a root directory. If you're used to Linux, you'll know there's a root directory. If you're used to Windows, there's no root directory. Yes, there is. They just call it a drive. So there's multiple root directories. So root directories are a common occurrence everywhere. And the directories contain directories and files. And this is the concept we are very, very familiar with. The slightly, you may or may not be familiar with this, but this gives rise to all kinds of possibilities that certain operating systems choose to limit. This means that we can have a directory tree, we can have acyclic graphs, we can have you thought this was easy, but it's not. You can have tree structured directories, which is the most common. We all use tree structured. That is, here's a directory, there's a bunch more directories and files in it, there's a bunch more directories. It's a tree. But when you have directories within a directory, it doesn't have to be a tree. I can make it some kind of a graph where you put the same directory in multiple places, you link things up in various ways. But it's probably convenient to have a tree. Linux allows something called acyclic graph directories, which is more than a tree. The same file can appear in multiple places. Windows won't let you do that. And Linux limits the acyclic graph directory that the file can belong to multiple directories, but directories cannot belong to one. No, even directories can belong to multiple. The same directory can belong to multiple directories, same file can belong to multiple directories, but there better not be a cycle, because that drives a lot of algorithms nuts. And they have pretty harsh rules that prevent you from cycles. You can create things that wouldn't lead to cycles, but Linux won't let you because it's paranoid you might create a cycle. So I think they don't let you put the same directory in two places, because then you can do something nasty and get a cycle. But so it's a strict acyclic graph directory. Windows doesn't let you do that. But if you don't do that, then you miss out on a bunch of opportunities, which is brought back by a kind of a strange idea called symbolic links. Symbolic links exist both in Linux and in Windows. In Linux, it's called symbolic links. It's kind of a kludge. And in Windows, it's called shortcuts. Okay? So all these are part of directory structures. This is a kludge because we don't want to have acyclic graph directories and a few other reasons which gets complicated. Mounting is allowed by Linux, not in Windows. Mounting is you have two trees in two different devices, and you can mount one point from here to another point of their cross-device links. Very useful in certain senses, but it's not for everybody to do. You need some privileges, and it can get you into trouble also. And what's more convenient, which both Windows and Linux will allow you to do, is that these two trees are on two completely different machines, separate machines. And mounting, two words for the same thing, remote mounting in Linux, and Windows calls it sharing, file sharing or something sharing. And they use different protocols. This is run by a piece of software called NFS. This is run by a piece of software called SMB. Okay. So that allows you to build these network file systems and what do they call those things? Appliances, I forget the term. Network attached storage. You can put a box which contains all your files and is visible from all the little machines at home or work or whatever. So that's done by remote mounting if you're running Linux, sharing if you're running Windows, and the NAS storage can do both, so you can be using Linux as well as Windows machines. But that's all the facilities. We're not talking how this is done. Where are we on time? Okay. How do they How are file systems implemented? The current answer is it's very complicated. Things have evolved and evolved, and features have been added on, and technology has been added on, so that it's become a very complicated field, and it's become very, very huge inside the operating system. So we have okay, I won't get into that. There's two old, well-known systems. One is very, very simple, called FAT, File Allocation Table. This is the system Microsoft built for really old PCs, which had really not much disk in it. It's obsolete. FAT32 still lives. That's on flash drives. But that's considered, never mind. But backward compatibility caused FAT32 to be around. And there's a reasonably sophisticated file system that was invented in the 70s called the Unix file system. This Unix file system and the FAT file system and various things led to the more complex EXT systems and the NTFS systems and the journaling system and the log structured file systems. That's where it gets into too much engineering that has happened. So what I'm going to do is, this is short and sweet and very well done. Yes, it's old, it doesn't, but it's possible to explain this instead of going there. So I'm going to go ahead and explain this, and you'll see how a simple file system that can support almost everything that we talked about can be built. It has aCyclic graph directories, it has multiple directory structures, it has mounting, it has sequential access, random access, naming, permissions, everything. But, so why not just, why are we moved out of the Unix file system? The same thing can be done in a different structure, that is NTFS. The same thing can be done but improved structures, that is the current Linux file system. So let's just go ahead and look at what a basic, easy to understand, clean file system looks like. Let's see, do we have time for this? Not really. But this is where I'm going to start next class. When you set up a Unix file system, you hard code a division in a partition. You have this division. This side is index blocks, this side is data blocks, and once set up, this cannot be moved. It's static. That's true for Windows also. There is the file table or whatever they call it, right in the middle. I forget the name of that thing. So all file systems have this pre-reserved segment where it stores things that are not part, that's not user files. It's their own data area. And that's the index blocks in the Unix file system. What's stored there are called inodes. And these are crucial things that allow you to build the file system. Here, it's mainly file data, things that are contained in all the files that we are storing. But that's not entirely true, because there's a part of it contains scattered index blocks. So between the inodes and the index blocks and some files which are actually called directories, we can build a pretty nice file system, and we'll look at how it's done. Okay?
Thank you. the project due tonight, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, it is tonight. So I've been trying to contact him the last 3 days with my partner. He did not reply to me, but I did the project anyway. I don't know if he lost his email or something. So I was wondering, I don't know if he did it, but he didn't contact me or something, but I already did.
Okay.
So I don't know if I can add his name. Maybe he's going to add my name. And if he did it, I don't know. I don't want to be in a confusion.
Oh, see, that part I wouldn't know. I mean, I can let you submit it by yourself.
Okay.
But if you add your name and he adds my name, then it becomes a mess.
I know. That's why I want to talk to you. I don't know if I should submit it by myself or should I add his name?
That you'll have to decide. If you submit it by yourself, you need to add a note to your submission that I have been unable to.
I can make a text file or something in the I'll do that.
Or in the comment section of the thing. You're just supposed to send an attachment, but in your email you can write something and you put it in the main program or README or something like
that. Yeah, sure, I'll do that. Okay, thank you very much.